You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 7 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I am Tristan Caracino.
We're here in scenic Boulevard Park, Washington. It's good to be back here after my trip to ESPN this week.
And we'll talk about that in a second. But today is a big day in Seattle.
A historic day, really.
It's one of the most important days in Seattle history. And that is, of course, because the Rainier R, which has been down since the year 2000, in lieu of a green Tully's T, is going back up tonight.
The city just hasn't quite been itself without the Rainier R there in place.
I absolutely agree with you. So there's a party going on tonight at the old Rainier Brewery, which you said is now condos, which I'm not that excited about. I would much rather it still be a brewery. But there's a party going on from 4 to 9 o'clock tonight, and the invite to the party, or the website, has some of the greatest words in the English language, which is, and of course, all the Rainier beer you can drink.
Which would be a lot of Rainier beer in many cases.
Hypothetically, I could drink. Imagine if this was going on while we were tailgating. That could be 25 Rainier beers. It could be a lot, though. But enjoy great music, a climbing wall, photo booth, fun party games, prizes, and of course, all the Rainier beer you can drink. Climbing wall and all the Rainier beer you can drink sounds kind of dangerous together.
That's not a great combination. But yeah, this is maybe the biggest party Seattle's had in a while.
Ever. I when I first heard that it was going back up, I thought, this is a big deal.
I was going to put the 79 Sonics Championship as a bigger party.
As a bigger party. I'm sure that there were bigger parties, but the Rainier are going back up. I mean, we haven't been down there yet. We don't know what it'll be like, but I'm hoping it's raucous, a raucous, insane, fun time.
And presumably also very foggy.
Yeah, that kind of is cool, because the Rainier R will shine through the fog.
Oh.
A bright red light shining through the fog.
And it's like the sign equivalent of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Yeah, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
That should be a seasonal beer.
That's a really good idea.
Wow.
Well, we're on to things here. But so I have a meeting tonight. I have to leave it early. Ideally, I would be there from 4 o'clock to 9 o'clock. The whole duration of that, and that could be a lot of Rainier beer during that time period. But I have a meeting to be at, so I have to leave that early to make it down there by 9 o'clock, but I'm willing to do it. I need to be there at this event.
Well, how long before 9 p.m. are you going
to
get there?
I'm hoping to be there at 7.
Because I have to leave early.
Why do you have to leave early?
I have a birthday dinner to attend this evening, so maybe ships passing the night. South Center.
At South Center?
Yeah.
Well, that sounds terrible. You're missing out on the Rainier Brewery celebration to go to that.
Well, but I'm going to have several hours of... I'm going to be several hours deep in the Rainier
okay,
Brewery
that's
celebration.
That's good. So I was driving over here, and I was coming up with various odes to the Rainier R. I was like, I want to come up with the ode. And what I really came up with was a few incomplete sentences.
Incoherent thoughts.
One-off thoughts about the Rainier R, and I want to read a couple of them. Okay, you ready?
Are you going to read them dramatically?
Hopefully. So, okay, here's the first one. Like the great Phoenix rising, the Rainier R returns to Seattle, a sign not just of our present, but the city's past and foreseeable future.
A future, you might say, illuminated by the Rainier R.
Okay, that was the first one. Here's the second one. The Rainier R is a beacon in the skyline, the giant red sign that says, you're almost home, in our case, growing up. Or the sign that you are home if you're returning back to Seattle, just as the Rainier R is returning. You gave me a knowing nod about that one. Like, yeah, good one. Good ode. Okay. Here's another one. This is my third one. This is the last one, unfortunately. And this is probably the craziest. The Rainier R presides over our city like the bat signal, comforting all onlookers and advising all threats to Rainier beer that it is here to stay.
All right, well, number one, is the bat signal really comforting? Because the bat signal indicates that something horrible has happened and Batman is needed to fix it.
I disagree. The bat signal is comforting knowing that something horrible happens in Gotham City all the time.
Really? Why does anyone live in Gotham City?
But But the Rainier bat signal. But the bat signal signifies that somebody is there to protect you, that you're not on your own, just as the Rainier R signifies that there is beer there for us to drink.
So what are the threats to Rainier beer that it's...
That actually, I'm going to tie this into this other question that I have.
Segway!
And you kind of sounded like Jalen Rose there.
Give the people what they want.
Which is, I was thinking about Rainier. Who killed Rainier beer? Why did... I'm doing it in my poetic ode voice still.
The entire podcast will be like that. I look forward to...
Zach Stacy is a brilliant running back.
I look forward to when you discuss our fantasy matchup in that voice.
I'm going to do that in the NFL Films voice. And make it the most dramatic fantasy
matchup.
Your voice
isn't deep enough for John Facenda.
But Rainier beer, I think it was a strong force, obviously, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, early 90s. I know that grunge embraced Rainier beer, and that those folks, basically your older Gen Xers, embraced Rainier beer. And something happened in the mid to late 90s, and Rainier really fell out of favor. I think there was a time period where they stopped brewing it completely, and then the Rainier R went down in the year 2000.
I mean, I tend to think the situation was more financial. Like, it became difficult. First off, not brewing it at the Rainier Brewery is a factor, and I think it took some time for people to get over that and start embracing the fact that Rainier, even if it's brewed elsewhere, is still our local native beer. Mm-hmm. So I think that was a factor, and I think it was more financial on, like, the business end where it was being distributed and things like that than people actually losing interest in Rainier, but I could be wrong.
That's a much less interesting response to that. You're like, it was a complicated financial situation. I probably was.
Did you just use a white person voice on my explaining?
About you? My theory was it was purely cultural, of course, because it's a much more interesting tale to weave. And in the mid-90s, something bad happened to Seattle. The music of Seattle, which in the early 90s was an edgier music, it was grungy, it was ugly, it was hard.
It was trend-setting.
In the mid-90s, bands like Harvey Danger became popular.
I like Harvey Danger.
Bands like the Presidents of the United States of America became popular.
Wait. You can't say the Presidents of the United States are not... I mean, they're not edgy, but they're unique, they're local.
I think that...
They certainly reflect, like, craft brewing or something like that.
That's one of the biggest problems that Seattle has had. Seattle is a blue-collar town that was invaded by white-collar people.
Seattle?
And I don't know if it actually is. But white-collar bands like the Presidents and Harvey Danger, nerds who go to UW and sing their goofy little songs about... flagpole sitting.
Things of that nature.
Raging against machines.
But here's the problem with that argument.
Irony took over. And irony is the worst thing in the world.
Oh, so irony is now dead?
I think so.
Wow. I don't know when that happened. Here's the thing, though. The Rainier does not compete with microbrews in the way you're thinking they do. Because microbrews didn't stop being popular in Seattle in the 2000s when Rainier made a comeback, did they? No, they're still extremely popular. The issue is not Rainier versus Pyramid or Rainier versus Red Hook. It's Rainier versus, frankly, Coors Light, the very debate we had on this podcast a few weeks ago.
And so you think that other domestic brews... were gaining that market share and took away from Rainier?
Cheaper. I think that they were more readily available.
And then what happened? Why is it better? I wanted to purely blame Microsoft types, folks who were moving here from out of town, because there was a big influx in the 90s of people who are more want to be drinking microbrews.
Californians is the term you're looking for here.
Californians. That was a terrible accent. People who were moving to Seattle who had no history with Rainier. And they're not the kind of blue-collar Rainier drinkers. They're the highbrow. I find it funny that we're talking about palate in other times. Not today, but in previous episodes.
Your complaints switch from week to week.
But you have to be able to balance the two. And that's where I agree with you, that Rainier is not competing with necessarily... Because Rainier and Georgetown Brewing can act in conjunction with each other very nicely.
I think there's a symbiotic relationship.
Absolutely. And so, but I'm thinking that there are a lot of folks who moved here. They have no history with Rainier. They're not the type of people who are going to drink a domestic six-at-a-time beer. They're going to, you know, have a couple fancy beers, have a porter with their dinner and things like that, eat their salmon with their porter, and they're never going to touch Rainier. And that's what happened in the 90s, but the culture is shifting back. There's not that same kind of influx, and Rainier is coming back in full force, and this is the real sign of it.
First off, I disagree, because those people are all still here, and they continue to drink microbrews, so you're wrong. But either way, the good thing is that Rainier is back, and the
That's
only thing that could make it better is if they were to resume brewing it at the Rainier Brewery.
I agree. I don't know if that'll happen.
But almost certainly won't.
Finding a place to have a Rainier brew house in Seattle, if PBR, who owns Rainier, could find a spot, Georgetown is probably the preferable place to have a Rainier brew house, or to even just have like the Rainier bar, where they could have Rainier seasonals, things like that, all sorts of one-off Rainiers, Rainier in different types of packaging. You could get Rainier in the bottle, Rainier on draft, Rainier in
kegs.
And kegs. That would really be great for me, and I think that everybody would like to go there. Who wouldn't want to go to the Rainier, and they would just call it Rainier Bar.
It would immediately become my second favorite bar in Seattle. I don't think it would surpass Oscars.
Oscars is your favorite bar in Seattle?
Yeah, Sean Kemp nostalgia is stronger than Rainier.
What about Loretta's? Are you turning your back on Loretta's?
I like Loretta. First off, technically not in Seattle. Oh, no, I guess it's
technically in Seattle. What are you talking about?
I was going to try and sound smart, and then it backfired,
backfired.
It often does.
Backfired.
But it's a solid number two, but
it's
Oscars
called
is number one.
Loretta's Northwesterner.
I don't have a tradition of having my birthday party at Loretta's.
Maybe you should.
Some other people do.
Maybe the future starts here. So anyway, the Rainier R is going back, and it is a momentous occasion, and it is a big deal for this particular podcast with the Rainier logo as our logo.
We weren't supposed to tell people that. We were trying to keep that lead quiet.
Nobody noticed. anything else on Rainier?
I think that covers it.
Thoroughly covered it.
We'll recap the event next week on the podcast.
If it's interesting enough. So you went to Bristol, Connecticut this week to ESPN headquarters.
World headquarters.
The world headquarters of Entertainment Sports Network.
Of the worldwide leader.
What happened? I haven't heard anything about this, so this is all new to me also.
Yeah, well, it's my second trip out there. We had our annual NBA meetings this week. So the first time I was out there was last December when I was going through the interview process and first got hired. That's my first time out there as an employee. And was there Tuesday and then the first half of Wednesday through the early afternoon. And the thing about the ESPN campus now, I'll consider myself an expert on it. This is SportsCenter commercials. Like, there are not players in the same way walking around as much. And there's definitely not mascots, sadly.
Not
hijinks.
Any?
Yeah, I didn't see one. I might have been looking in the wrong place.
Unfortunate.
But they're really, you just see like all these people you know from TV just walking around campus, and it's like totally normal.
I mean, they work there.
They do. But, you know, if you're like an outsider, it's a big deal to see all these people. And if you're on the ESPN campus, then all of a sudden it just becomes, that's part of your daily routine.
Who did you see?
Herm Edwards, Colin Cowherd, Stephen A. Smith. Jason Whitlock was there with my co-author, the Per Diem, Tom. He was at rookie camp together, and he came over and hung out with us while we were taking
it. Is it ESPN rookie camp? What is rookie camp?
Yeah, just to like orient people who are new hires.
And so Jason Whitlock was the new hire?
Yeah.
That's really funny.
Yeah, that's
cool. Along with Tom Haberstroh?
Yeah.
And you didn't get to go to that because you haven't officially finalized your contract?
Yeah, and I don't think they're going to fly me out specifically for it.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
You know, after 6 hours in a middle seat yesterday, I don't know that that's the worst thing in the world.
Do they do them? Is there another rookie training camp?
Apparently every couple weeks, because there was only like 20 people at it or
every
something.
Every couple weeks?
Yeah.
It's like the rookie symposium, though.
Well, it's not like they're like telling players to avoid groupies and things like that.
They might be.
No, it's more, it's, you know, like
John Buchagross comes out and gives them like the real truth about being an ESPN employee.
It's like any company orientation with new hires. I think they had a thing explaining how to use like your company like account login. So it's not that exciting.
Yeah. Jason Whitlock thought it was all racially biased.
But
you couldn't respond to that. As an ESPN employee, you can't say anything about that.
So the two most notable things I think that happened to me while I was there. Number one, and this is just the surreal, like, famous people are just all around you. I'm jogging on the treadmill on Tuesday night back at my hotel near the ESPN campus, and Bill Polian walks in and gets on the step machine next to it.
Really?
Yeah.
How old does he look in real life?
It's about the same.
Okay.
And then number two, the most famous person I met, I was not introduced sadly to Colin Cowherd, even though he talked to our group. He was kind of in and out because I think he was actually taping his show at the time. But I did meet George Carl.
George Carl?
Sonics legend.
Really? Does he work for ESPN?
Yeah, he's an analyst in the studio this year.
Really?
Until possibly if he gets... I could see him not being there for the full year. I've predicted that he will be the first coach hired, but... For now, he's with ESPN.
Did you talk to him? Did you tell him who you are?
We didn't really go into great depth. He was having a quick meeting with my friend Dean Oliver, who also works at ESPN and formerly worked with me at the Sonics and with George Carl with the Nuggets.
Really?
So.
George Carl, I find that pretty interesting.
Yeah.
How does he look?
he's doing pretty well given that he's beaten cancer, I think, maybe twice now.
Yeah.
Yeah, prostate cancer and throat cancer. So
he is probably the legendary Sonics coach.
Lenny Wilkins.
Still Lenny?
I think. In championship, but he's definitely number two.
Anything else from ESPN? You drank some sort of beer that you sent to me?
Yeah, there was a Goose Island Matilda. I was thinking about that when you were talking about people having their salmon and drinking their porters. That when they took us all out to dinner on Tuesday night, I had like salmon Caesar salad and then drank these fancy beers that were the most notable thing was...
You were the problem, is what you're saying.
That's what I'm saying. It wasn't served in a beer glass. It was like kind of like a wine glass, so one of those kind of fancy beers. But mm-hmm. it was very good.
They do those with like the higher alcohol beers where they have to serve them in smaller glasses.
Yeah.
Where they typically only give you like 10 ounces or something like that.
And, I first had...
Is that a popular micro over there? Goose Island IPA?
Or? No, it's a Chicago, so I think it's a national thing. But as you see, it comes in the wine-looking bottle also as well. And,
wow, that is the most pretentious beer I've ever seen.
Rated in 99 by the bros. So it just seemed like something I needed to try.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good rating. That looks like a real pretentious beer. Comes in a wine bottle. God, it's been sitting in a wine cellar for quite a long time also.
Look, all I care about is it a good beer, and it was terrific, so.
You should have been drinking Rainier. It would have been like those Samuel Adams ads. Everybody around the table would have ordered, I'll have a Rainier.
No, they wouldn't have known. They just would have served us the beer, and then at the end, they're like, you were drinking Rainier.
Yeah, George Carl would know it. Dean Oliver would know it. I'm guessing you were at dinner with them.
They were not at dinner. I imagine that George Carl has probably had a Rainier or two in his time over at... where we determine he likes to like to drink.
George Carl liked to drink?
Yeah, we discussed this. The place you like to go.
Mecca?
Yes.
George Carl liked to drink at Mecca?
He was a regular at Mecca.
Oh my God.
When he was the Sonics coach.
Man, I wish that I was older in the mid-90s. I could have been hanging out at Mecca with George Carl there.
Yeah, you missed out.
There's no basketball team there now, so there's nobody who... I feel like Bob Hill might have made it over there a few times.
Bob Hill was not a Mecca type.
In the early 2000s.
Bob Hill was definitely not
a Mecca. He was too fancy for Mecca?
Oh, yeah. Bob Hill, like, had his... Like, he had his haircut at Salon Philippi, and, like, he once folded Percy Allen's pocket square during a pregame interview.
Man, no wonder he was a terrible coach.
He was just very concerned with his appearance, and he also once gave us some tips on tucking your shirt into your underwear to make it look better fit.
That feels uncomfortable to me.
I haven't tried it. I can't say I've tried it, but Bob Hill, style advice.
Anything about what you're saying right now. But I do like hearing that George Carl likes to drink at Mecca. I was thinking that Mecca is one of two bars, I know there are more, that I can think of that have Rainier in the bottle, which is the Smoke Shop in Ballard. Definitely have it. I think that's the most drunk beer at the Smoke Shop. And then also at Mecca, they have Rainier in the bottle. I usually go for the High Life and the Draft, but now I feel like I have to change that completely. I feel like I have to start living a Rainier lifestyle 100% of the time.
This podcast has really forced you to commit to it.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of legendary coaches...
I was going to make that exact same transition.
Yeah. Okay. I'll get you to it.
Same page there. So legendary Husky coach, perhaps the most legendary coach in all of Seattle history.
We can maybe debate that, but I think yes.
Don James, unfortunately, died at the age of 80 on Sunday, October 20th. And I think we should just take a second to talk about memories of Don James, if we have any personal memories. By the time he was done coaching, I think I was 7. So I don't have that many personal memories, but What do you remember?
A little more for me, because I was 9 during the 1991 undefeated national championship season and 10 during Don James's final season. So I definitely was, you know, a fan and aware of kind of what was going on. And the one thing I didn't realize back then was, hey, this is a really rare thing. Like I first followed the Huskies basically during 91. The only game I remember, a couple of games from the 1990 season. I remember the 1989 Freedom Bowl, but 91 is the first season I remember start to finish. So I don't remember the Huskies losing a game until like the late in the 1992 season.
You're always talking about that Freedom Bowl too.
No, the Freedom Bowl is one of my defining childhood memories. But the Huskies were on something like a 20-game winning streak, I think. Until late in the 92 season, looking to defend their title, and they lost at Arizona. And I was just so furious because I did not understand that this is what occasionally happens to football teams.
Sometimes, you probably should have been furious. Sometimes, was that a good Arizona team?
Yes. No, okay. That was a very good Arizona team. Desert Swarm. They had, I think Teddy Bruschi was there at that point. I mean, they were legit, but the Huskies kind of fell apart after Billy Joe Hobert's suspension at the end of that year. I think lost 2 or 3 of their final 4 games.
And so the suspension happened mid-season.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that's kind of like the 91 team and the sanctions are kind of the two defining moments of the Don James era in hindsight.
Yeah, especially because they happened at the end. I mean, I think that, you know, if we were around and if they had occurred later, like taking a Warren Moon team to the Rose Bowl, that sort of thing, the, you know, the 85 Orange Bowl is also a big one. But yeah, and the sanctions... You know, I specifically remember, I will never forget that day because...
In 1985, they won the Freedom Bowl.
No, the Orange Bowl was played on January 1st,
1985. Okay, the 1984 season, okay. Always bring it back to the Freedom Bowl.
Always do. We were all out at our aunt and uncle's house because our dad and several of his brothers and some of their friends shared season tickets at that point, and they always had a draft to pick which games they were going to.
And I'm excited to talk about our basketball draft next week. We're going to talk about that. Anyway, go on.
We are going to talk about that. So they were drafting, and as they're doing this, we get the word about first the sanctions, and then the Don James has retired. I mean, that's a pretty big 1-2 letdown team that has been to the Rose Bowl 3 years in a row and just riding high.
And this was about 2 weeks before the season started.
Yeah.
So I was asking Mom about it, if she had any Don James memories. And she crazily just brought up the dog father poster that we had in our house growing up.
I don't think there's anything crazy about that. That's one of my defining Don James memories.
It really is mine also. So there's Don James wearing, I believe, a tuxedo, looking very slick, because he was not that old at that time.
Wait, would you like to see it? I've actually got the link up.
Make sure to post that on the page.
It already is there.
Oh, great. But there's that with the purple roses. And then there's also a real men wear purple poster, too. With Don James. But so I was asking Mom if she had any defining memories, and she was talking about that moment. I guess she was out there, and I guess the whole family went for the Husky draft. And she said that it felt like somebody died when Don James quit.
I can totally imagine that. I mean, it was a stunning thing. Because, you know, in the modern world, like, very little happens that is actually a surprise. Like, there's always, you know, oh, there's a rumor about it on Twitter, something like that. Like, it didn't work like that in 1993. Just things happened and you heard about them and you were blown away.
I think it's pretty insane. I mean, you have to think about current sanctions that happen and pretty weak sanctions that happened in Miami that came down earlier this week. And you have to look at, I mean, USC athletic director Pat Hayden is really upset because of the harsh penalties placed on USC, but basically literally nothing going to Oregon when they get probation.
I think maybe 1 or 2 scholarships.
But that's ridiculous. Yeah. Any team could lose 1 or 2 scholarships.
USC is the only punishment anywhere comparable to it in recent memory.
And Penn State, and they're even going soft on
Penn State.
Yeah, but
Penn State wasn't a team that was winning national championships beforehand, so that's why I mean, in terms of severity, it was comparable, but in terms of, like, stopping a dynasty.
But those sanctions, when they came down and how harsh they were, I mean, we all think that it was unnecessarily harsh. Another reason to be mad at the Seattle Times, too, but...
Well, I mean, that's the interesting thing. Someone posted a link, I think, to a Don James interview from not long after he retired and was pointing out, like, he was really angry, both at the Pac-10, which actually handed out the sanctions, not the NCAA.
Oh, really?
but then also with the local media.
Yeah.
And there's a strong sentiment amongst Husky fans that the Seattle Times brought them down by doing their job,
and
basically.
It basically ended the program. They held on for a little while after that. It was kind of trickling away, and then it completely fell off, and the program has not been the same since then.
It's definitely not been the same since then. I don't agree that the sanctions did that. I think it's a series of coaching issues.
So Don James, he was the guy, right?
The guy.
Don James was, I mean, most of the major colleges have somebody like that, but he was the Washington guy. He was Bear Bryant, Bo Schembechler, folks like that.
Woody Hayes.
Yeah. Where it would have continued, Bobby Bowden, it would have continued for a long period after that. And some of those other programs were able to transition in much more natural ways. Like, you look at the Florida State transition after Bobby Bowden to Jimbo Fisher, and it's a much more natural transition.
I don't know. I agree with that. Bowden was basically forced out at some point because of his age. And, I mean, that's the upside, is that Don James was able to go out on top.
They were able to maintain their level of play for a long period of time, continuing after Bobby Bowden into Jimbo Fisher. And now they're back to one of the best teams in the country.
But it's crazy. So Bobby Bowden was 3 years older than Don James, 3 or 4. And he retired 4 years ago.
Yeah.
It's very weird to think about. There's a scenario where Don James could have still been coaching.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if he still would have been, but he would have not retired that long ago.
Yeah, he did say in interviews that his physician had told him that you would have been dead within 5 years because of the stress of continuing to coach.
Physicians always say that. Somebody probably said that to Bobby Bowden in 1991. I guarantee you that somebody said that to him, and he was like, screw you, I'm a football coach. I'll die out there in the field.
Yeah, well.
I'm telling you, that's just what people say. The stress is really high. But
it is hard to imagine.
The thrill of success.
Because it's been 2 decades. It seems like a really long time since Don James has been the coach. And it has been.
But you have to wonder also, will there ever be another guy like Don James? Before him, it was Jim Owens.
Jim Owen, yeah.
Jim Owen. And then there's Don James. Don James controlled the program for 22 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's possible because, you know, Lorenzo Romar has been at UW for, I think now his 11th, or I think this is his 12th season, mm-hmm. and I anticipate him being there for the foreseeable future. I think he could be there as long, but to have one singular figure be as important, I don't know. I mean, I think it's like all culture. There's so many more options now that you don't have the kind of like dominant figures in the same way that Don James was.
It's true. It's definitely what a college football program is looking for, where you've had the success to a certain point, and at some point it just doesn't make sense leaving also. Like, Don James would never have left UW to go work at USC. Once you reach that level of success there over that sustained period of time, I mean, Coach Sark is the obvious person to talk about right now. If Coach Sark in the next 5 years were to reach some sort of elite level of success and choose to stay beyond that point and maintain it, the chances of him ever leaving go way, way down. It's basically like they become really high that he would leave if they reached an extreme level of success. But if he chose to stay after that, the chances of him leaving go way down and he'll just retire the head coach of UW.
Exactly, because UW is the kind of program where you can compete at that national championship level. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't programs that are better positioned for it, like USC, but it's not like you would need to go somewhere else to have that opportunity.
Absolutely. But when you think of Don James, what do you think of? What is, I mean, to me, it's all the, like, coach speak type things Herm Edwards would say. Toughness, grit, force. You think of that 91 defense and Steve Ettman and Dave Hoffman with their half jerseys going after quarterbacks.
Well, my friend Seth Colin had a really good post about what, like, Don James didn't really act like he had a philosophy. Like, Pete Carroll has a whole book about his philosophy. Don James probably never even used the term philosophy, but he did sort of have a philosophy. And then one of the most interesting things about that is, as much as we associate him with the kind of this old school tough guy style of football, mm-hmm. the way the Huskies played changed dramatically in the early 90s to set up that run of success, where they embraced the spread offense with Keith Gilbertson as the offensive coordinator, where they went to the 46 defense that Jim Lambright coached that was so successful. And it made me think kind of a Chuck Klosterman essay where he talks about how football is simultaneously like the most conservative sport in terms of how it's played, but also the most liberal sport in that new trends will sweep through the country very quickly. And John James is like one of the ultimate examples of that to me.
That's interesting. But I do think that that defense is what dominated that perspective. I mean, there are great offensive players for a long period of time, but the lasting memory of Don James and the thing that Husky fans, and maybe we'll talk about this when we talk about kind of where the program is going right now, but a thing that Husky fans, and it's probably because they're old white men, that Husky fans want is they want to get back to this point where we're just demolishing teams physically. Basically what the Seahawks are doing. When you see the Seahawks and you see that they have the number one defense, they have these massive defensive linemen, and they've got 10 of them. They've got huge cornerbacks, and they're a physically brutal team in the way that it's like this traditional football, and that's where folks want the Huskies to be, and that's how we view Husky football as a program.
Yeah, it's kind of like the platonic ideal of Husky football was set by the 91 team.
Absolutely. If there could be, okay, let's say that you could win a national championship in multiple different ways. One of those ways was winning like Oregon and being like a fast-paced, up-tempo offense, potentially giving up some points, although they aren't this year, but really relying on finesse and speed and quickness. And the other way was the exact opposite end of that spectrum, more toward Alabama is right now, where you have a physically imposing defense. You're winning games against LSU 6-3. You're crushing teams in the national championship and not letting them score. Obviously, everybody wants to be Alabama, but
I mean, just in terms of pure results, yes, but stylistically.
But stylistically, you want to – Husky fans want to be that Don James team. And that's really what he did to the program is he made it like this
is – He made expectations way too high?
Well, not necessarily that. He defined what Husky football is.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I mean, Jim Owens was also a very tough guy coach, so I don't think it was totally new. And the other interesting thing is that also – the other trademark of UW during the glory days was a consistent run of great quarterbacks. Mm-hmm. So it's not really like the, you know, there were very good running backs as well during that period of time, but it's not like Alabama where you've got guys that are, you know, called game managers winning national championships at quarterback.
It's true. So that definitely is a difference.
That's one difference. But the thing I'll say to your point is I don't feel like there's been almost any time within the last two decades where Husky fans have been satisfied with their team's tackling.
Yeah.
Every single year, we think the Huskies are bad at tackling. And it's not because sometimes they are.
Yeah, last week, they were bad at tackling.
Last week, they were legitimately bad at tackling. But often, it's because of the fact that, like, the 91 team sets such an impossibly high standard with these amazing, hard-hitting players, including the number one pick of the draft.
I mean, I suppose that's true with the Seahawks right now, where, like, if there's a game where somebody misses a tackle, one tackle. We freak out. It's devastating for us. Because when you've come to expect this like sound defense and like a kind of a harsh defense, that you expect it to be that way all the time and you never want to give anything. But I do think that's an interesting thing about Don James and how he's set up the program forever. I mean, it's been 20 years and we're still in the same position where Don James is who we want.
Well, unless another team wins the national championship, I just can't envision that changing.
Another team wins another Husky team?
Yeah.
I wonder, do you want to talk about transition to the Huskies and talk about where the Huskies are right now, basically? I mean, we can talk about Arizona State, but I don't really want to.
I definitely don't want to.
I was listening to sports radio on Monday morning because normally there's the Pete Carroll show on, but since they played on Thursday, that happened on Friday. So Monday was all Husky talk on sports radio, and that wasn't fun.
it was a good time to be in Bristol, except the fact that they had like the countdown to the Rose Bowl there. That was a little turn in the knife.
But do you want to talk about like? I mean, we can talk about that. We'll talk a little bit about Cal after. But first, just state of the program, how we see the program right now.
Well, I think you know, as I started to touch on with the John James thing, it all comes back to it's all about expectations and whether they're realistic or not. And I think that Husky fans, first off, didn't realize how good Arizona State was.
I agree.
And then probably got too high on the team during the start and didn't recognize the difficulty of this three-game stretch. Like, the fact is, you know, probably the Huskies, there's a lot of the time they should have won one of those three games, and they very nearly did against Stanford. But in not one of those games were they the favorite by any realistic measure. So it's not surprising that they went 0-3. And, you know, I think the magnitude of what happened at Arizona State, the way it happened, was certainly disappointing. But I think fans are too low on the Huskies right now. If you look at statistical outputs, whether it's Sagarin, whether it's Football Outsiders, various metrics, the Huskies are still, you know, somewhere around the 15th best team in the country.
It's true, and a similar thing happened last year where there was a tough stretch, and then there was a long series of games that the Huskies could have won every single one of them. They ended up laying an egg against Wazoo,
yeah,
and then against Boise State in the bowl game in the Las Vegas Bowl, and those two games really ended up kind of defining that season when they should have won both of those games. And they're kind of set up in a similar position this year, where, I mean, they definitely should beat Cal and Colorado at home. At UCLA is a really hard game. At Oregon State is a hard game. But then should beat Wazoo. If they were to win four of those five and then go in and win a bowl game, our whole perspective about the program could be vastly different.
Yeah, and I think that's what we talked about this a little bit last week, that people were saying this is a must win. Well, that's because you're evaluating it based on how we're going to look at it now. But if the Huskies were somehow to go on and win the next five games, I mean, I can't really...
That feels pretty unlikely.
I can't envision that happening because UCLA and Oregon State are both so good. But in that scenario, no one's going to remember the Arizona State game and how bad that felt at that point. People are going to be riding the high of the five-game winning streak. So it's, you know, it's always you're going to overwrite what happened recently. And then the other thing that humans have a tendency to do is just like a natural fundamental bias is we attribute too much of what happens to our own efforts, in this case.
As fans.
In this case, the team's efforts.
Yes.
And not enough to the circumstances or the context, and in this case, how difficult a three-game stretch that was.
It was a difficult three-game stretch. I think playing at Arizona State with our style offense is really difficult, and a lot of folks have talked about this. I mean, it's 80-degree weather, and we played during the day, which is one of the few day games that we've really played and are probably going to play all season, so it's a little bit strange that that one wasn't at 8 o'clock when it would have been a little bit more moderate temperature-wise. But if you get a couple three and outs and your defense has to stay on the field for these extended periods of time, they're going to get extremely tired, and Arizona State just wore us out and the game was over.
Yeah, and the offensive line had a really bad day. I mean, I think that's the one thing that's a long-term concern to me. The other thing being that, you know, Coach Tuck didn't really seem to have any answers on offense. He, when plan A didn't work, there wasn't really a good plan B, and I hope that there's some learning from that.
I agree. Coach Tuck seemed exhausted throughout that game. He kind of definitely seemed like he didn't have any answers and seemed like it was just like, whatever. You know? It's over. Who cares?
Just like the team as a whole, defeated.
Defeated. And that kind of came after those two losses. And I do think Arizona State wasn't a must-win game, but for defining the fan interest and the general interest for the rest of the season, I mean, people are not going to be excited about this Cal game coming up.
No one was going to care about the Cal game. I mean, I think
if we would have won two of those three games in that stretch, the Cal game would feel much more interesting.
Yeah.
There would be a lot more interest in the program, and right now the interest in the program is extremely low. The thing that I'm most excited for is tailgating on Saturday.
I still think it's going to come back. If you beat Cal and Colorado, if you take care of business the way the Huskies should and blow those teams out, quite frankly, then going into that UCLA game on a Friday night, possibly two top 25 teams, I don't think that's out of the question, then I think that would be a very big game.
The UCLA game is definitely the game to circle for as far as saving the season. But I want to think even bigger than just the season and kind of the program as a whole right now. And it's shaping up to be a 7-6 season, something in there. It's not shaping up to be a great season. Maybe 8-5.
I mean, I think if it's 8-5, and especially if you play well in a bowl game and leave a good taste in everyone's mouth in that regard, then...
But the real question is, this is kind of the season in a lot of ways where most likely ASJ is not going to be here next year. Keith Price is not going to be here next year. Sean Parker is not going to be here next year. There are a lot of significant players who are not going to be on the team next year. So, I mean, it all kind of depends. We thought this on Jake Locker's senior season, too, and the team was better the next year with Keith Price. But are the chances that Siler Miles coming in is going to be better than Keith Price? Seems pretty unlikely.
Yeah, I mean, everything was set up this year, and that's why it's tough that the Pac-12 just happened to be, you know, arguably the best conference in the country this year ahead of the SEC, and especially the Pac-12 North. So I don't think it's that the Huskies have... The Huskies have overachieved. They've played better than I expected, certainly, and it just hasn't translated because of the fact that the schedule is so ridiculously difficult.
I suppose best-case scenario long-term, looking 5 years out, is you've made a bowl game for quite a few years in a row, you consistently stay at an above-average clip, and eventually you have one team that's going to pop. Or when you think about Texas A&M, like Texas A&M was a good team, but they got Johnny Manziel, which is... the Huskies could have a player who pops like Johnny Manziel has or Brett Hundley has. And you have somebody like that, and they kind of move you to the upper echelon. You go from being a perennial bowl team, and you get bumped up one time, and that helps you kind of maintain that level.
To me, the other thing that could that is positive that's come out of this season is the way the offense has worked has shown if you're a talented, skilled player, if you're a good athlete, and you come to UW, your skills are going to be taken advantage of, and I think that will help immensely in recruiting.
It's true. And the other thing that I think is really important is just consistency. Right now, we're going, this is Sark's fifth season?
I think so.
So maintaining that consistency with Coach Sark, not just losing faith in him at any point among the fan base, or if you were to leave, consistency is always the best thing in my perspective, unless you have Tyron Willingham as your coach.
Or Keith Gilbertson.
But consistency is very important. Tyron Willingham was not a bowl coach. Tyron Willingham was an 0-12 coach. But Coach Sark is a bowl coach who clearly has the ability as a coach to bump his team up to another level. So keeping him around, I think, gives them a chance long, long term.
Well, that's the elephant of the room, is the USC job, and will he be kept around?
Right now, I would say that the chances of him getting hired at USC feel very low.
And, I mean, they're not going to hire someone coming directly off of a 29-point loss, I don't presume.
I mean, obviously...
You know what the other interesting thing is, by the way, about Don James that has come up in the wake of that? Like,
yep.
That he was, like, the fourth choice, and that they hired someone who had just gone, I think, 7-4 at Kent State. Like, the concept of that happening again in 2013, the blogosphere would flip out.
Without going to a bowl game. The program is in a different place then. I mean, with the expectations that we have for a coach are now different because of what Don James
did. It was a little bit, but I mean, they're not that far removed than Jim Owens era at that point.
Lorenzo Romar was a similar situation though also where he was...
Yeah, but he was UW grad. He was a guy who had been an assistant coach at UCLA on a championship team. He wasn't the first choice, but that was a much easier sell in terms of exciting for the public.
Do you want to talk about Cal coming up?
No.
Neither do I. Just looking through there, I think that Jared Goff is probably going to start the game as their starter. He's thrown for a lot of yards. They're clearly picking up yards, but he also has 11 turnovers. And they've been crushed in every single Pac-12 game this year.
I would say from what I've seen of Cal, they're in a similar position to where Wazoo was a year ago, where they're just getting the offense in place. They're bear raid instead of the air raid, mm-hmm. and figuring mm-hmm. out what they got, and then they'll start to really... actually be competitive potentially next year. But, you know, I agree with what Coach Sark said yesterday. There was a question to him about the Cal defense, and, you know, while this isn't good from the reporting standpoint, he said it's not about the Cal defense, it's all about us.
Yeah.
And I totally agree with that.
That's absolutely true. In the games this year, they've given up 44 points, 30 points to Portland State at home, 52 to Ohio State, 55, 44, 37, 49. The Huskies should score at least 45 points.
They're the worst defense in the Pac-12 statistically. So, yeah, the over-under is set pretty high for offense.
And the Cal offense has been not great either. Cal's terrible. I don't know what to say.
I mean, ideally, I think you get an early lead and you get Siler Miles in, assuming that Keith Price starts as quickly as possible, A, to get Price some rest, and B, to get Miles some experience against a Pac-12 opponent in case you need him the rest of the way, which it seems very possible that you might.
That's true. Chances of winning?
95%.
I was going to say 95 also. Yeah. I could imagine a scenario where the Huskies come out and lay a real egg, but...
It's unlikely.
It feels very... It would be devastating as a program. Coach Sark's job would start becoming threatened if they were to lose to Cal. Cal or Colorado, either of those two games.
Those truly are must-wins. I will give those the must-win stamp.
And then the Seahawks, Monday Night Football. You said you wanted to spend a chunk of time talking about this game because it's Monday Night Football.
What's Monday Night Football? It's a big deal.
I don't think Monday Night Football means anything anymore. Did you think that Giants-Vikings game last Monday night was a big deal?
You know, we actually had a conversation about this.
In ESPN?
Just when we were at dinner watching the game. And first off, more people watched that Monday Night Football game than watched the World Series last year. I don't think they've got the ratings in from game one. But, okay, so the very worst possible Monday Night Football matchup, the lowest combined record of two teams week seven or later in Monday Night Football history, and still more people are watching than a World Series game.
The ratings were very high for that game. I was reading a Deadspin story about it.
But here's the thing, is you're always going to have a fantasy player playing on Monday night and be interested in that, and it's football. People watch football. People watch the Raiders-Chargers game
what you're
at 11 Eastern.
It's not necessarily that Monday Night Football is a big deal, just that you can take out the Monday night part of that. Football is a big deal.
That is true. But there's also still a Monday Night Football brand. I mean, you're playing when everyone else is sitting at home watching. I mean, I'm starting to quote the commercials, I think, now. But, yeah. You know.
Been waiting all day for Monday night.
And here's the thing is, for a lot of years, the Seahawks were not on Monday Night Football that often. So it was something you took advantage of and cared a lot about when they were.
At some point, I mean, I don't know if we need to debate the merits of Monday Night Football. But at some point, Sunday Night Football became much better than Monday Night Football.
Well, it's written into the contracts.
It is written into the contracts?
Yeah,
because NBC is paying more for it than ESPN is.
Yeah, and then also the ability to flex changes that significantly. I mean, you know, Minnesota and the Giants didn't look like a great matchup on paper, but I don't think anyone suspected that the Giants were going to be winless and that Minnesota was going to be as terrible as they were.
The only game coming up, so you've got Seattle at St. Louis, Chicago at Green Bay. That's not a terrible game. Miami.
I mean, that would have been a good game if Jay Cutler wasn't hurt.
Miami at Tampa Bay, which is a terrible game. New England at Carolina, which is okay.
That could be a big game by that point if going for it, Ron Rivera.
I think that we play in the biggest of the coming Monday Night Football games.
Without question.
But there's San Francisco at Washington, which I've circled on San Francisco's schedule as a potential loss. There's really just that. They go at New Orleans and they host Carolina. Those are the three potential, and also playing us at home. But then New Orleans at Seattle on week 13, Monday, December 2nd. That is a game that I'm looking forward to.
That is going to be a big one. People are going to be amped up. It'll be the second biggest home game of the year, obviously. But that and the San Francisco game.
Until the playoffs, hopefully. Knocked on wood.
Good call. That and the San Francisco game are so far ahead of everything else on the schedule.
All the other garbage on the schedule. So Monday Night Football, we go into that playing the Rams. The Rams just lost Sam Bradford for the season. Which makes it an even less interesting game.
Hopefully.
And what do you think about Sam Bradford?
You know, he was actually having a pretty good season. There's a lot of talk about his future in the wake of this injury, his giant contract and everything like that. But he was throwing the ball, I think, the best of his career over the first 7 weeks of the season.
Yeah, I mean, that was a weird thing that I kept hearing. Somebody was saying that there wouldn't be... It wasn't that big of a deal that Sam Bradford was hurt for the Rams, that Kellen Clemens wouldn't be that big of a drop-off. And I thought that was such a crazy thing to say. I think that Sam Bradford has played really well, but the general public just hasn't noticed.
Well, because it hasn't translated into wins.
They're still 3-4. Yeah. They're not a terrible team by any means, and they've played some really good teams in there. It was weird with Sam Bradford. At some point, I think there was so much hype and he didn't play well enough for so long, or mediocre for so long.
Well, I mean, he was pretty bad last year.
That
he was legitimately pretty bad.
Everybody is determined that they hate Sam Bradford, basically. In fantasy, he was the top quarterback not to be on a team, and he was like the eighth quarterback. Yeah. He was a quarterback who probably should have been on a team, but he still wasn't because it's like a Sam Bradford.
Well, he had some matchups. I mean, I considered him with my quarterback woes, but... His schedule was not really great.
In DVOA, he was 11th, and that puts him ahead of Andrew Luck, Cam Newton, Tom Brady, Jay Cutler, Colin Kaepernick. So some quarterbacks who you would definitely consider, quote-unquote, good quarterbacks.
Or at least they're famous star quarterbacks. They're not people who you're talking about cutting after the year.
The drop-off to Kellen Clemens is pretty significant. Did you ever find any stats on Kellen Clemens?
Yeah, he last played in 2011 and had a minus 11% DVOA. I think he completed like 55% of his passes.
So Seahawks defense playing against Kellen Clemens.
That's an appetizing matchup.
Bradford was hurt near the end of that game last week, right?
I think so.
And so we didn't see a ton of Kellen Clemens. But the Rams were already an offense that was not moving at all before then. I mean, I watched the game, the Thursday night game against the 49ers, and I was like, this is the worst offense I've ever seen.
Well, they got a little better after they got Zach Stacy in at running back, because their running back situation before that, they're averaging under 3 yards a carry, I think. Darrell Richardson had a minus 28% DVOA. Zach Stacy has actually been an above average running back by DVOA so far.
Yeah, Zach Stacy has gotten things moving a little bit. Part of the conversation, I'd say a little bit, I mean that. But part of the conversation, they crushed Houston
Yeah.
But did it largely through turnovers and kind of stifling the Houston offense. Sam Bradford threw like 16 passes in that game.
But their offense played well when it was on the field. It was just like a bunch of long Houston drives that ended in turnovers. It was a weird game.
But there's been a lot of conversation about how that... So they traded up to draft Tavon Austin. 2 weeks ago, he played two snaps.
Three snaps.
The more recent week, he's played a little bit more, and they tried to get him into the offense.
And he fumbled.
He had a long play that was taken back by a penalty also. So that was nice. But Brian Schottenheimer, the Rams offensive coordinator, I would say, is probably his last year on the job.
might be his last week on the job.
He's been heavily criticized by not getting Tavon Austin into the offense. They kind of found Zach Stacy. But now, the person who's hypothetically getting Tavon Austin the ball is Kellen Clemens.
Well, I think that actually might be a reason to get Tavon Austin more involved, because you're not throwing a lot of... You're not asking Kellen Clemens to make a tough throw or a tough read. A lot of what Tavon Austin is going to do is underneath stuff, at the line of scrimmage, you know, wide receiver screens, things of that nature. So maybe this is an opportunity for them to use Tavon Austin more.
It's true. And they have the other threat, who is Jared Cook, who for years upon years was always... Felt like he could be a huge tight end in Tennessee, and they couldn't quite utilize him. He got to St. Louis, had a big first game, and has been non-existent since then.
He's been, you know, a little bit, but he hasn't presented that deep threat as a tight end that I think people are expecting. And I don't think I'm that worried about that with Kellen Clemens under quarterback.
No, I mean, it takes out a big chunk of their offense. I think back to the Football Outsiders preview, which was in the Football Outsiders Almanac, reading about the Rams. Before the season, I was thinking that the Rams probably would be a pretty solid team. It felt like they were a pretty good team last year, and they're adding Jared Cook and Tavon Austin. But Football Outsiders was really down on the Rams, and they were especially down on them because of how much youth they have on offense, and that it basically, in the history of football, since in the DVOA era since 1990, there's never been a team that young that has been a competent team.
What surprised me, you know, I think that first off, Football Outsiders was pretty dead on a lot of that. But what surprised me is that their defense has been as poor as it has, because, you know, I watched them play in the preseason. Alec Ogletree had a monster game. I think that was against the Broncos. And it looked like they've got all these young pieces on defense where it tends to be better to have youth, and that those guys would come together. And instead, they've been 30th in pass defense in the NFL so far.
30th in pass defense, which you have to think Russell Wilson is going to take advantage of, and then also 32nd against the number one wide receiver. So in this case, we're assuming that Golden Tate is Seattle's number one wide receiver.
Yeah, it's not as big of an advantage for the Seahawks as it would be someone who really relies on riding that one guy. But
they've been terrible against every receiver. Good against the tight end.
Yes.
They've been good against the tight end, so Zach Miller might not be as much of a factor in this game. But somebody like, I think, Golden Tate, Sidney Rice, Doug Baldwin...
Jermaine Kearse.
I mean, there's the potential of Percy Harvin playing, which we'll talk about in 1 second.
Yeah.
But
they've also been bad against running backs out of the backfield. So maybe also, Marshawn Lynch screen or something like that.
Yeah, Marshawn Lynch catching the ball. So I would expect the Seahawks, I mean, depending on if the lead opens up pretty big, they might turn to the ground game a little bit more after that. But I would expect them to open it up passing the ball. And I mean, it's not like the Seahawks don't know this information. They don't know how weak the Rams have been against the pass. It seems like Janoris Jenkins, who kind of seemed like he would be a star cornerback last season, has really regressed this year.
Well, he's too busy Googling information about Steve Smith's family.
He just learned how to Google. That was weird. We'll see if he Googles anything about Golden Tate. If he figures it out for a second week in a row.
I mean, if you're going to do it against Steve Smith, then you probably are doing it against everyone.
I think Golden Tate could scrap a little bit. Steve Smith, obviously, noted fighter. But I think
best of the NFL.
Golden Tate, I think he's built.
I agree. He's got a good fighting build.
He's a short, stout man. I would rather fight
Sidney
Rice than fight Golden Tate.
Yeah.
Sidney Rice is taller. But Golden Tate seems much more aggressive. He breaks all those tackles. I would not want to fight him.
He sometimes breaks into top pots for donuts.
Also, Marshawn Lynch, not a person I would want to fight.
No. Under no circumstance.
But you'd have to assume that the Seahawks pass defense or passing offense is going to gain a lot of traction against the Rams. They'll be able to move the ball pretty easily there.
Yeah. I think, you know, you probably get out to an early lead and you hope to just put pressure on Kellen Clemens, force him into a couple of mistakes, and that could turn it from a close game into a blowout, just like we saw against Arizona.
Absolutely. And you would assume that the Seahawks D-line with all the different moving parts is really going to be able to tee off on Kellen Clemens. I would predict 2 interceptions by Clemens and 5 sacks.
Oh.
something in that range. I mean, you take the number one defense in the league and put them against Kellen Clements starting his first game since 2011. That's a good situation.
I feel good about that.
Yeah, we're going to be doing this a lot for a lot of the future games. You look at Minnesota coming up at home. I mean, you've got potentially Christian Ponder, potentially Josh Freeman. You got Mike Glennon coming to town.
Oh, man.
There are so many of these games coming up where it's like, who is going to be the quarterback?
I actually fear for Mike Glennon's safety.
Mike Glennon has not been that bad. He's not been as bad as Josh
Freeman.
Yeah, but
like his pocket awareness?
Yeah.
I mean, it's one thing to throw the ball. It's one thing, but if you never even get the chance.
He also just looks scared all the time.
Exactly.
Look at Mike Glennon. He's going to be scared. And then Percy Harvin. It's looking like Percy Harvin's probably not going to play this week. Any thoughts on what it would look like if he did?
Well, I just think there's no need to push him for this game at this point. You know, get him. He's gotten some good work in practice with this extended stretch, but I think another week
would be more helpful. They practiced so few times.
Yeah, they took a lot of time off. It seems all of last week.
They practiced Tuesday, and they're practicing today, and it's like, that's the only times they practice. But it has been an extended stretch. It's been, I would assume, nice rest for everybody involved.
Yeah.
It's really nice to not have Russell Wilson get hit for a long period of time. And hopefully against St. Louis, it's kind of weaker run defense and their weaker pass rush. He won't be taking too many shots this week.
Well, I'm really curious to see if Daryl Bevel is using this as a time in practice as an opportunity to work on how Percy Harvin is going to be integrated into the offense.
I think they absolutely have to be. You know, like playing around with it among the coaches right now before instituting it and just figuring out all the different options. I don't think that he's going to play this week. I think he probably will play against Tampa Bay in a limited role and then really come back and start and like play against Atlanta.
Yeah.
In 2 weeks. I think that'll be his first, like the first game that Percy Harvin really takes an active part in, but it should make a difference.
That makes sense. And I'm curious to say, because we saw the Seahawks offense evolve so much last year with the read option and some pistol and all sorts of things like that. So Daryl Bevel has shown a willingness to mix things up midseason to adjust to his talent. And, you know, Harvin is going to be a unique talent.
Chances of winning for this one?
80%?
Yeah, I don't want to say 95 because they're on the road. If they weren't on the road, it would be up in that. Or if they were at home, it would be up in the 99% range. I'm going to say a 90% chance of victory and 100% chance of devastation if they lose. I mean, that's with any game. But
I say that 100% as well.
So
should we talk about the bet from last week?
Yes. Yes, we should. So we bet last week. We were playing each other in fantasy. It was not a fair bet. Going into it, your chances of victory, very low.
That's, yeah.
But if I would have lost to you, I would have had to only drink Coors Light while everybody else drank your
Rainier,
whatever.
Nectar of the gods.
I'd have to
refer to it as
Nectar of the gods standalone and be staring at you looking upset. I actually came up with a better bet, which is that I can't drink at all. That is a much better bet. And if we play each other in the playoffs, that's what I want to do.
Okay.
I don't know why I would want to punish myself more, but you have to do something more extreme. I want to talk about that in 1 second, though.
There won't be any Husky football games at that point, you're aware.
It's the more extreme thing I'm going to talk about in 1 second.
Oh.
But so you have to shotgun a beer, which really doesn't seem, I mean, it seems like a normal thing, but for you, this is a point of much stress, correct?
Yeah, I don't like shotgunning beers.
Are you panicked?
I'm not panicked.
Are you nervous?
No.
If you had Snapchat, you would have gotten a Snapchat of Chris perfectly shotgunning a Coors Light that was sent to me on Sunday night. It was just like, psh, I'm motioning, well, shotgunning a beer perfectly. It doesn't translate very well.
Not so much.
But
just wait till we start recording these on video.
But he perfectly, we'd have the Dogfather poster behind us.
Yeah.
But he,
Rainier poster.
He shotgunned a beer so perfectly, and that's what I'm expecting to see from you. Because if too much of that beer gets on the ground,
it's going to be number two.
It's going to be number two.
Well, that's the thing, is I'm not very practiced at it since I don't like
shotgun. I'm really hoping that you fail at number one. My fingers are crossed.
Especially the fact that we're probably going to be taping this.
Yeah, oh yeah, definitely. Do you feel comfortable with a Vine video going on to your Twitter?
Probably.
You'll post it?
Yeah.
I can record it with your phone. Do you have Vine on your phone?
No.
I'll record it, and then we'll record all the way through of the shotgunning, and then you know how you do that pause thing for a second, and then there'll be you looking sad after.
That should be great.
Really looking forward to this. It'll update your brand a little bit, your personal brand. If we do play each other in the playoffs, and there's a chance, I think there's probably a pretty good chance that we would play each other in the playoffs.
I don't think I'm going to make the playoffs, so...
Well, if we do, the bet will be, not drinking. There'll have to be some sort of situation, maybe a Seahawk game where I can't drink or something like that.
Yeah.
So it will be me not drinking, and then... recounting our greatest bet of all time. I'm pretty sure that this was a bet.
Greatest.
This was 2003, 2004.
I think 2004. I think I was out of college.
It was a bet about whether like the Arizona Cardinals would win 8 or more games.
Was that what it was about?
Or maybe whether the Seahawks would host a playoff game. It was some inane thing that we bet on. And the bet was that I could throw a snowball.
No, that wasn't the bet.
Oh, that was... Oh, okay, what was the bet originally?
The bet was whether you could crack an egg on my head.
If you lost, I could crack an egg over your head?
And then as a compromise, you offered...
You didn't want the egg cracked.
No.
And so you wanted to be struck with a snowball. Because it had snowed. And we were in that yard right next to where we're recording.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was the night after the Holiday Bowl.
I packed up a snowball really tight. I'm doing the packing motion. Packed up a snowball really tight. It was icy in there. And I was aiming probably for your chest. It was all in fair play.
And so I'm standing there and I'm covering my face.
And I threw the snowball. It was about 15 feet away, 10 feet away, as hard as I could. Pow, right in the kisser.
In the kisser?
Struck you right in the balls with the snowball. Fell to the ground. Comic hilarity. It was like an episode of America's Funniest Home Videos. You like over accented the falling to the ground. There may have been a scream. Ah!
I probably would have been higher pitched than that at that point.
You fell to the ground holding your crotch region. And then I think you just walked home.
I was down for like 15 minutes. It was extraordinarily painful. It was an Anchorman moment. I immediately regret the decision to take the snowball.
You could have had an egg over your head.
I think you may have been supposed to be throw multiple snowballs as part of the bet. But it was so bad, the devastation of the first snowball, that the bet was immediately canceled.
You were down for a long period of time. Wow, so I'm saying that that's something we could potentially do again. If you
will never ever do that again.
That is the only thing equal to me not drinking at a tailgate.
I don't know. We'll come up with something.
You were saying earlier that you still have long-term testicular damage because of this. I feel like that can't be true 10 years later. But that was some bet. It was a thing of beauty.
It's all beauty is in the eye of the beholder in this case.
So I can't wait for Saturday when you have to shotgun a beer. I'm hoping that you fail in the first one and have to do a second. You said, I want to remember the game last week, because if you shotgun two beers, you would not remember the game at all.
I just think that there are some people that occasionally do not remember parts of games.
No, I cannot coherently review a Husky game. I'm sure after the game, I'm like, there are things that happened.
There are plays.
I know that I was there.
I think that'll probably be the highlight of the tailgating this week. Otherwise, kind of low-key and a very late tailgate.
Yeah, 8 p.m. start time.
That's the latest start game I can ever remember.
I think it has to be the latest start time. It's definitely the latest in Husky history.
Yeah.
But I'm kind of looking forward to it.
I am not.
Okay.
Well, I
like nighttime tailgating.
You're not going to get back until, like, midnight.
What do I have to do? I'm not a farmer. Well, ferry nearly hits fishing boat in fog. That's what our Husky football game experience is going to be like. But on Saturday, I would assume that it's going to be really foggy, so that might be kind of cool.
Yeah, that actually kind of would be
cool. The fog rolling in, covering the stadium, it'll be really eerie for the first game right before Halloween. I look forward to that.
Yeah.
And then we closed talking about fantasy. It was a weird fantasy waiver claim this week, to recount, as everybody heard. I destroyed you in fantasy last week.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Let's be clear that I had a chance until Knowshon Moreno and Demaryius Thomas both scored touchdowns in the Sunday night game.
You have to expect that that's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like surprising that they both scored touchdowns. But through halftime, I had a shot. I had a real chance.
Yeah, you had a real chance.
And even Victor Cruz had gone nuts on Monday night, which he has a couple times this season. It wasn't out of the question.
All right, fine. But I also
unfortunately, he's playing with Eli Manning.
Two players go on IR during that week. Well, Doug Martin's not on IR. Doug Martin, who probably will be done for the rest of the season. Reggie Wayne, who is on IR, is confirmed done for the rest of the season. So that was kind of devastating.
Yeah.
And I've been put in the position to have to try to find replacements for both of them.
Yeah.
And my first goal for replacement was Jarrett Boykin, wide receiver for the Green Bay Packers, 100 yards and a touchdown last week. And you claimed him.
Yeah, and I just put that in. That was like one of those waiver claims of obligation where I'm like, just in case, learned my lesson on that last year.
For some reason, I thought there was a chance that I would get him. I considered talking to you beforehand and trying to negotiate a trade where if you were to get Jarrett Boykin, I would trade with you. But I don't know that I don't know what assets I have to give you. Jacquizz Rodgers is the only asset that I have, and you're not interested.
The weird thing is, even though my team is not very good, I have just like ridiculous depth of mediocre players. I have tons of guys that I feel comfortable playing week to week. It's just that none of them are that good.
There was a big run for kickers. I was trying to get Garrett Hartley, the Saints kicker, who is coming off bye, and I'm sick of Dan Bailey, and did not get my kicker, which is the first time that has ever happened. And it looks like one of the other teams there also didn't get... I'm assuming that that was put in, the Jay Feely claim, because they also were trying to claim Garrett Hartley and didn't get him.
Well, I didn't get my tight end. I was part of the run on tight ends with Antonio Gates having a bye week.
And who was the tight end that you had claimed?
Jeff Cumberland.
Jeff Cumberland. Jeff Cumberson.
And so instead had to settle for Heath Miller off the free agency scrap heap.
And then so talking about tight ends, we had a whole thing recorded for last week's podcast and ended up deleting it. But that
was only slightly less long than this week's.
But it was a long thing about me going through how I chose Jordan Reed as my tight end replacement for Jimmy Graham, who was on bye and also injured. And I look like a real genius now. The name Fantasy Genius, it's not there arbitrarily. I didn't just make it up. Well, I did just make it up. But there's a reason that I call myself the Fantasy Genius. Jordan Reed, 134 yards and a touchdown last week. He looked just like Jimmy Graham out there, Washington tight end.
Which was completely unpredictable from the fact that he had four catches for 56 yards the week before.
It was an amazing performance, and it's what beat you, this Jordan Reed performance. Yeah. All of the other tight ends, there were other folks who got touchdowns that I could have claimed. I think Kobe Fleener had a nice game.
Yeah.
But if I would have gone with somebody like Joseph Fourier, I would have lost.
Yep.
And Jordan Reed propelled me to victory out of nowhere. He was being played in like 1.1% of leagues. Right here. Played him to defeat you, and now you will be shotgunning a beer on Saturday.
Does your back hurt?
My back hurt?
Yeah, from where you've been patting yourself.
That's really, really clever. Really clever.
We close, as usual, by looking at Jermaine Kearse's performance and where he stands in that season-long race with Vic Ballard, who, again, remains injured and out for the year.
Yeah, Vic Ballard has a 7 still, I believe.
And one catch for 17 yards on Thursday night for Jermaine
Kearse. A point.
He had 3 targets. He really, his catch rate way down.
Yeah.
So his DVOA is sinking considerably from 138% where it was at his highest point. But he is now at...
24.
Yeah.
So he's really crushing Vic Ballard in that comparison.
Yeah. If it was a fight, we'd stop it.
I think that's it.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you.